All right, show of hands. How many of you were in a school play when you were a child? Most of you, in some way, shape, or form. I grew up around the theater, mostly community theater, though. So my first school play wasn't until I was in about fourth grade. And I got a stellar part. I was in The Christmas Carol, and I was the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Which meant my entire part was this. I pointed, and Scrooge freaked out. It was a pretty simple part, and from the reviews I got, I seemed to have aced it. What was interesting, though, was that after that play had finished, I had a dream. And it's strange, it's one of the few dreams I remember from my youth. But it was very vivid, and like most dreams, it kind of floated from scene to scene, place to place. But it ended in a courtyard, and I was walking through past some trees and saw some stones, and I walked up to the stones, and one of them was my gravestone. Ouch. I woke with a start. Art imitating life, life imitating art. But that was kind of a painful prodding to my spirit to have a nightmare like that. You know, this parable is much in the same way. Because what do parables do? They point. They tell a normal, everyday story that points to a greater reality. It points, points, points. And after a while, some of them, you get a point and you go, ouch! Because it hits us in a sensitive place or in a place we weren't expecting. This parable is one of those. And it's not unlike one of those movies that you've heard about that achieved artistic brilliance and has a very poignant and powerful and cutting message, a movie like Schindler's List, that you realize, I really need to see that. And then once you do see it and you're blown away by it, you say, and I never want to see that again. Because it hits close to home. Because it does point in a way that causes us maybe to flinch back in recognition, in shock, but also with insight, maybe a little too keen of an insight. Jesus tells this story to a crowd that include his followers, that include some of the religious leaders of the time, and maybe even a smattering of onlookers. And he's been telling this sequence of stories that have been building in intensity and really kind of reach a fever pitch at this point. And we heard the story as I just read it. And it's an imaginary tale of role reversal. In life, the rich man has, Lazarus has not. Roles are reversed after this life. The rich man receives many blessings throughout his life. Lazarus is denied many blessings. The roles are reversed. Now Lazarus is receiving comfort and encouragement. And the rich man is denied those sources of comfort. But he's not only denied, he's also in denial. You see, the rich man in life had erected a wall between himself and people like Lazarus, between those who have and those who have not. And really, throughout his life, even though Lazarus was right there, even at the foot of his table, hoping for the crumbs, he couldn't see him. He didn't recognize him as another human being. While Lazarus very well could see the rich man, well, in the story, the roles are reversed. Now the rich man can very clearly see Lazarus where he is, and the wall has become a chasm, a valley between them. And ironically, Lazarus cannot see the rich man, although he can hear his voice. You get the sense that Jesus is trying to communicate something here, that the rich man built that wall, which became a chasm through indifference to the poor, those who were in need. That indifference was a hindrance for people like Lazarus to be able to engage in life in all of its fullness. But now that wall, that chasm, is keeping himself from fully living. The beggar is now exalted. The exalted one is now literally a beggar. But the rich man is not a typical beggar, because even though he's suffering, he's still trying to call the shots. Did you notice that in the story? Then when he sees what's happened, he calls out to Abraham and he says, "Send Lazarus, my lackey, to bring me a cool drink. It's frying down here." Send Lazarus? As if he's in a position to still be calling the shots? "Who does he think he is?" asks Jesus. And it goes on. Well, if he can't get some relief for himself, at least he can play the hero and save his brothers from the same fate that he's experiencing. So, once again, send Lazarus to warn them. Send Lazarus? He's not picking up the full picture. He's being denied, and he is in denial. And Abraham says, "No, they've had a Bible full of telegrams sent to them already. They can dig them out of the trash and read them for themselves." Well, now the rich man's kind of desperate. And so he tries to put on a supernatural show. Send a dead man. Send someone who's risen from the dead and come back to life to wow them into paradise. Once again, send someone. Send someone. I wonder if the question Jesus is asking me through this story, and perhaps all of us, is this. Through the way we are living our lives, the way that we perceive others, the way that we perceive the gifts within our own lives, are we consciously or unconsciously building a chasm, a wall of fear between ourselves and a life with others? Or are we building a bridge of trust, of faith, between us and others? I think about some of the statements that come into my mind when I see someone who is in need. Whether it's someone right here in our neighborhood, or I read about or see someone on my computer screen or my TV screen, of people who are suffering injustice, who are starving, who are homeless. And what's one of the thoughts that comes into my mind? Well, I feel bad for them, but there, but for the grace of God, go I. Thank God it's not me. Thank God it's not my loved ones. I wish I could help them solve their problems. I may have a roof over my head and gainful employment, but it's not like I'm rich. Until I read that if I were even living at the individual median income in Portland, I may not be in the top 1% in the United States, but worldwide, I would exist in the top 0.28% of income worldwide. I'm not rich. With each one of those statements, as well-intentioned as they may be, I wonder, am I putting another brick in the wall? Am I digging that chasm a little wider and deeper between me and them? Could one of the reasons Jesus is telling us this story is to help awaken us to the fact that the way we were created to live this life on this planet is not to view other people as them, that perhaps the reality of life isn't us and them, but we. Could it be that the calling is not to see people or a group of people in need as a problem to be solved or a project to be endeavored, but rather simply as people to be loved, to be accepted, to be embraced and welcomed and treasured just for being who they are? And that takes me back to Oscar Schindler. That Squirm-worthy, brilliant movie that many of us have seen. Oscar Schindler was a very successful businessman in Germany, the beginning of World War II. He had wealth, power, status, had it all, was a member of the party that was in power. He was esteemed greatly by people who were in the upper echelons of society. When his business was starting to be compromised, and he was wondering if his business was even going to survive, he then sought out this alternative. The fact that there were some Jewish citizens who were available to work, and that by offering them employment, it might save them from a much worse terminal fate. And so does Schindler instantly become a humanitarian? No. He doesn't do this in order to save these oppressed people. He does it to save his business. And save his business it does. But in the process of that business transaction, he begins to see these people. He begins to recognize them for who they are. And he also notices their loving sense of community and care with one another. Even in the most difficult, trying, life or death circumstances, here they are, caring for one another's needs before their own. Here they are, supporting and encouraging each other in tangible, simple, beautiful ways. And over time, Schindler finds his mind beginning to change, and his heart beginning to open, and his perspective beginning to broaden, to the point in his story when it's time for the workers to be able to have safe passage to a safe space. And he comes to say thank you to them and to wish them well as they depart. He's not thinking about the bottom line. If you saw the film, you know what happens. They give him a letter thanking him, signed by all 1,100 Jews who worked for him and with him, people whose lives he had saved. And he looks at his car, his limousine, and he doesn't see that as a sign of security or well-being. He looks at it and he says, that's 10 more people. And he pulls a ring off of his finger and he holds it up and he says, this is a gold ring. I could have got 2 more people to safety. And he breaks down and weeps. And what he's saying is, I wasted so much. I could have done so much more. There could have been more lives saved. And one of their leaders, the faithful bookkeeper, reminds him of a Jewish proverb when he says, he who saves one life saves the world. These were no longer a project or a problem to solve. These were people to be loved. It was no longer us and them. It was we. We are them, they are we. How can we respond? I would venture a guess that the first step would be simply to step back. And when we look at a person or a community of people who are in need, Don't see a problem, see people. See a person needing love, needing a listening ear, needing a caring heart, a welcoming spirit. Our discussion in the Wine and Theology group on Friday night, as we were talking about issues of racial injustice and protest, ultimately came around in our meandering and wandering and very passionate but heartfelt and wise way to pretty much the same conclusion. That maybe this is the first step we can take, which could even be perceived by some as a step of protest, is not to demonize the other or not to bury them in an avalanche of pathos, but to simply see human beings and to accept and to connect and to love. And the next step, maybe instead of saying, send someone else, maybe our response could simply be, send me. Send me. Amen.